You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 11th of March 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, high-level talks prove fruitless in the effort to bring an end to the war in Ukraine, while all the while people continue to flee. The tanks edge closer to Kyiv and the food runs out in Mariupol. Also coming up, Russia's President Vladimir Putin warns of soaring food prices if the West persists with sanctions. We'll ask what the global consequences are for the cost of what we eat and who'll be hit hardest. We'll go through the papers and get the latest trade news too, as the war in Ukraine causes ever greater instability. Plus, Andrew Muller fills us in on some of the stories we may have missed, including this rare moment to raise a smile.
We learned that Russia's embassy in Vilnius, beautiful capital of Lithuania, now sits at two Ukraine's heroes, which is going to look awkward on the Russian ambassador's new business cards.
That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick summary of the latest headlines. Russian forces have made slow advances towards the Ukrainian capital Kyiv. It's been reported they're attempting to encircle the city. There have been reports of blasts in two fresh parts of Ukraine overnight. Lutsk and Dnipro, on opposite sides of the country, have been hit for the first time. And the US is to join the G7 and the European Union in calling for the suspension of normal trade relations with Russia. It's a change that would raise tariffs for many Russian products. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, half of the residents of the Ukrainian capital Kyiv have now left. Russian tanks are edging towards the city. The Red Cross has warned that in the city of Mariupol, they're now running out of food and water. And the highest level meeting yet to be held between the Russian and the Ukrainians has ended without any progress. Well, to assess the latest developments, I'm joined by Inna Draganchuk, who's Ukraine's Deputy Minister for Veteran Affairs, and James Rogers is Associate Professor of International Journalism at City University of London. Good morning to you both. Inna, good morning, Inna. Let me begin with you first. Could you just outline the latest developments from Ukraine, please, overnight?
Yes, I've already mentioned that the new cities were under the fire, and one more city, it's Ivano-Frankivsk city. So Lutsk, Dnipro and Ivano-Frankivsk, it's the new points of bombing for Russians for this night. All the objects which they wanted to do is just the airports in Ivano-Frankivsk, and about other cities I'm still not informed.
And what does that signify for you in terms of it being a fresh step in the conflict?
For this moment, I can comment it because yesterday's negotiations, they just demonstrated there is no new signals for us that the war will be finalized or that it will be finished nearest time. And the new points on the map of Ukraine and which are under the fire, it's just a demonstration from Russian occupants that they want to operate all other regions, not only those where it's under the fire from the very first days.
James, let's talk about these negotiations that happened yesterday in Turkey. We had the Ukrainian foreign minister and we had the Russian foreign minister sitting opposite each other for the first time that this level of discussion was happening since Russia's attack on Ukraine began. There were zero expectations of a ceasefire, were there? Or had there been some sort of hope that because the two sides were willing to sit down together, there was something that they had to say and something that they had to listen to?
I think there were zero expectations of a ceasefire, unfortunately. I think even the Turkish hosts of the talks were very much playing down expectations beforehand. It's interesting to note as well that afterwards the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, actually said that the main diplomatic process he felt was the talks that have been going on in Belarus between representatives from the Russian and Ukrainian governments. But of course, none of the representatives involved in those talks are at anything like as high a level as Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Kuleba. But so I don't think there was any very much expectations. And it was pretty clear as well from the requirements that were placed, that the Russians advanced, for example, a recognition really of the territory of Ukraine that they seized already, of that being theirs, and an undertaking from Ukraine that it would not seek to join NATO or the European Union. I mean, these are clearly conditions that there was absolutely no way that the Ukrainian side could accept. And so I suppose it was important for both sides to show they're engaging in talks, but I think we're a long way, unfortunately, still from anything substantial coming out of the diplomatic process.
And the narrative that's coming out of Sergei Lavrov's mouth is he's reiterating the Kremlin's allegations that the West has caused this conflict by forcing Ukraine to choose between Moscow and Europe, that the West is creating a danger in the region, and that those who are supplying weapons to Ukraine should be aware of what a dangerous move this was. How much, Inna, is this getting back to Ukrainians, and how difficult is the war of information and disinformation getting?
I can say that there is a disinformation war in Ukraine, because all our citizens are united now around one idea, and there is no example of successful even attempts of this disinformation war within the border of Ukraine. About the disinformation campaign around Ukraine and around the world, of course, we see how it is ruined because of your support, because of the real information channels which provided by your colleagues. And that's why I see that Russia become more weaker with every day, because they used to use this information weapons as a cultural weapons as well as the one of their army. But for this moment, they are absolutely weak and become weaker every day.
Last night, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned of Russia's disinformation campaign, speaking in Russian to people who still believe what is happening, still believe the narrative coming out of Moscow. What does that say about what the president is worried about in terms of how difficult and powerful the message coming out of Moscow could be?
The president just wanted to demonstrate that there is not any bridges, any differences between language we communicate, and that the most important just to bring the very first information from his personal opinion and not to permit Russians to make any other statements instead, which Ukraine wants to say, that we want to be a peaceful state, a democratic state, and please don't be afraid of us. That's all.
James, tell us what your assessment is of this incredibly difficult war of information that's now coming out. It seems in the last few days that Russia has absolutely galvanised its narrative from what Sergei Lavrov was saying yesterday and from this astonishing meeting at the UN Security Council, which is due to happen later on, where Russia is accusing Washington and Kyiv of managing laboratories intended to produce biological weapons.
I think, you know, we have to remember, Mr. Lavrov, whom I've interviewed a couple of times when I was a correspondent in Moscow, is no fool. And he's quite aware, he's quite sure that the West doesn't necessarily believe what he's saying. One of the important things, though, in this information war is for Russia to make sure that it keeps hammering home its narratives for the domestic audience. Because remember, the entire justification of this campaign has been because Russia is under threat, so they have to keep repeating this. And I think that's really what's going on here, that Russia wants to hammer this home to its domestic audience. And because after all, and it's interesting to note that Mr. Lavrov also insisted at the talks and after the talks yesterday that Russia's military operation, as he termed the invasion, was going to plan. Others would suggest that this was meant to be over much more quickly than it has been, that Russia has not achieved the military objectives it sought to do for a number of reasons, not least that it has met an unexpected scale of resistance. So Russian public opinion needs to be prepared and needs to be propped up for the fact that this is not going perhaps the way at all the way it was intended to.
James, just tell us a little bit more about what you are worried about, what is going to be happening next. I mean, when we talk about this disinformation campaign and the biological weapons issue, that has in the past suggested that this is what the Russians are planning, because the information, the intelligence that's coming out to the United States never seems to be that far from the truth, does it?
It does seem so far to have been remarkably accurate, particularly the nature and scale of the invasion. I mean, I think, Emma, the only thing that really turned out not to be right about that was the date. And it is, of course, possible that date was altered in response to the fact of this having all been made public. I think, you know, Russia is doing a number of things. I also note yesterday that Sergei Lavrov sought to calm fears about nuclear war, you know, saying after saying when he was asked about that, he said, I don't want to believe it, and I don't believe it, saying that that's not likely to happen. But of course, just a couple of days into the conflict, we had President Vladimir Putin of Russia sending that very strong signal by putting the nuclear forces on alert. Now, this doesn't mean to say, of course, that Russia intends to use nuclear weapons in the conflict, but it was a very, very, very clear reminder, just saying to the West, you know, we have got these. And on the eve of the invasion is underway. And remember, too, Mr. Putin talked of consequences the like of which you've never seen before. I think there's only one thing that can refer to. So it's important. It's part of the communication war. It's part of the thing to try to break the morale of the other side. But it is, you know, the fact remains that these the Russians do have these weapons, and that, of course, in the unpredictable way that this conflict is unfolding, the prospect, the possibility that they might use them is very much there.
Irene, you know, I think we can get you back now on the line from Ukraine. As Deputy Minister of Veteran Affairs, what is the spirit and the resolve like among the military?
The spirit of our life is absolutely clear, and it is we're absolutely united, as I mentioned before, about the idea of the victory of Ukraine and about Ukrainian further integration into civilized world. Let me comment, please, about the weapons and biological weapons and biological safetiness. To be honest, we even didn't communicate about this issue. We didn't discuss it within the frames of our government because it was so stupid and so awful for us that we didn't know how to answer. So we were shocked. You know, there are some moments when you're ready to comment, to explain and to make any arguments that it is not true. And we were just shocked. And after that, of course, there were a lot of jokes of our Ukrainian citizens about this statement, Russian statement about our weapons and biological, etc. issues. Veterans around the world are coming back to Ukraine. I mean, not only Ukrainian veterans, but you feel this huge support of international legion, international veterans who are agreed to support Ukraine. And that is the main idea of our society for this moment, that there are not representatives of the government, there are no volunteers. For this moment, we are so united, like, you know, the whole body. We feel that the real nation in these days are really the strong nation of Ukrainians has been appeared. So this is the most important achievement. Unfortunately, the price of this achievement is absolutely awful, but we are very optimistic and we definitely see our future.
Staying with you, Inna, when you see your future, when you hear that there is still no direct help to close the skies above your country, how does that leave you? Well, how does that make you feel?
You know, it's very difficult to comment because very first days and weeks, I asked your colleagues, and it was just the only question for all of the mothers of Ukraine just to close our sky. There is no reason if you will be able to close the sky or not. We will defend our country. We will fight for Ukraine, for all the Europe and for all the world. And you know, it's not just the world. For this moment, we feel ourselves very responsible for your security as well. Maybe you don't understand clearly the situation of this war, but I'm sure that you do, because your great support, even emotional support for all of us, for all the citizens of Ukraine, is absolutely overwhelming. But you have to understand that for this moment, even if you don't ready to close our sky, because it's all very high political level discussions. For me, it's clear, but for you, not. But at the same moment, we still continue. Be sure that we defend not only Ukraine for this moment. And even this argument make my nation, make our nation so strong for this moment and so united.
Inna Draganchuk, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Ukraine. And my thanks to James Rogers as well. You're listening to Monocle 24. 10:16 in Antalya, which is where we head now to Turkey, where world leaders, including the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, are gathering for the Antalya Diplomacy Forum. The theme is recoding diplomacy, a difficult but necessary task, given that we live in a moment where arguably diplomacy has failed to stop a war. Well, Chris Chermak is Monocle's news editor, and he joins me on the line from Antalya. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Emma.
We are in a period where diplomacy has failed, aren't we?
Yes, I think that's pretty fair to say. And if you've listened to the panels yesterday and speaking to some of the people here, there was already a sort of pre-conference yesterday, the Istanbul Mediation Conference in Antalya. And yes, the mood is one of a little bit of shock, if you will, a little bit of recrimination in terms of why were we not able to prevent this as diplomats and mediators. But at the same time, you know, this is a conference where people are trying to look forward and think about what this means for diplomacy going forward. How do you prevent conflicts in the future? How do you better prevent conflicts in the future before they break out?
And so who is gathering there to try and solve this problem?
So there's a whole range of people who are here from lots of interesting countries. It's one of the things that makes this forum particularly unique, to be honest, being here, because it is, as you mentioned, NATO's Secretary General is potentially here. Finland's foreign minister is here. But then you also have the potential foreign minister of the Taliban here. Venezuela's officials are here as well. So it's quite a range of people that are gathering here for a conversation about diplomacy, the role of diplomacy, but then also, you know, there will be lots of bilateral meetings potentially on the sidelines between different groups as well. So yes, it is quite striking in terms of the range of people, which and also it shows a little bit what Turkey's role is in all of this. The fact that Turkey is trying to set itself up as something of a global mediator and bringing in really lots of different players into that.
Tell us a little bit more about the timing of this. I mean, not just because of the fact that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is now 2 weeks on, but the fact is that yesterday we had the meeting between the foreign ministers of Russia and Ukraine, where it was absolutely clear that the positions on either side were unbreachable. And the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was accusing the West of orchestrating all this.
Yes, so that meeting was really quite significant yesterday. Frankly, a coup, if you will, for Turkey to be able to host that meeting, and Turkey's foreign minister, who was part of the mediation between the two foreign ministers. That said, yes, nothing huge came from the meeting itself. There was an agreement to continue talking, potentially even to work towards at some point in the future setting up a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky and Vladimir Putin. That's probably the biggest positive, if you will, out of that. Otherwise, yes, Ukraine's foreign minister certainly was not particularly positive on the meeting, saying he had come with specific things in mind, creation of humanitarian corridors, getting aid into Mariupol in particular, and that he felt that Sergei Lavrov did not really have any opportunity to make decisions on that, that decisions would have to be made out of Russia. But that said, I did speak to one mediator who is here, Janne Talas. He's the CEO of CMI. It's a Finnish mediation group. And I asked him what his takeaways were from the meetings of the two foreign ministers yesterday.
I think it was important that they took place. I think that's my first point, that the foreign ministers met. This is the first time, and it's really it implies mutual recognition. And I think that gives us hope for the process. That's the first point. The second point is really, it seems to be that the sides are not ready to really get into the weeds of negotiating. It's not kind of mediation in a situation like that, war situation. It's really about negotiations, and both sides need to be engaged and motivated and willing to go to try to find a negotiated solution. If there's a sense that, hey, I will still try the military option, or that is still available, or that is still kind of feasible, negotiations can rarely go forward.
Chris, we have the words of a mediator there who has to put a hopeful approach on things, because if they can't, no one else will. But when you look at the fact that there's going to be a meeting of the UN Security Council later, convened by Moscow, because they are saying that they're worried about the US and Ukraine building biological weapons on their on Ukrainian soil, and the US is accusing Moscow of gaslighting. What does that say about the wider structure of diplomatic channels and where the world can have its arguments without resorting to conflict?
That's a very good question, Emma. I did actually put that to Yanitalis as well. And this was also a topic yesterday and going into today among mediators. There is a fair amount of criticism of international organizations, multilateral organizations, for not really able to be present and offer a more constructive role in this conflict. At the same time, of course, they're pretty hamstrung, aren't they? One thing that Yanitalis pointed out to me was the fact that this is the first time in such a long time that we have had one of the permanent members of the Security Council in Russia engaged in a war like this, an invasion of another country. So how can the United Nations, in that sense, deal with that? That's where a conference like this, part of the goal, if you will, is to open up the opportunity for new players to get involved, whether that is Turkey itself, which does have strong relations with Ukraine, which it is arming, but at the same time also has strong relations with Russia and seems to be a relatively trusted partner. But there are also other sort of mediation countries here that are trying to raise their profile, if you will. Kuwait's foreign minister gave quite a passionate speech yesterday opening this mediation conference, talking about the importance of international law, respecting state sovereignty, and working to prevent conflicts going forward. But I found, for example, you know, Kuwait was one of these interesting examples of a different country that maybe, you know, might be able to take more of a role going forward as a trusted partner that isn't the traditional either multilateral organizations that you were mentioning, or for that matter, a Finland or Switzerland or Norway, countries that have kind of chosen a side in this, understandably, of course, with this invasion of Russia, implementing sanctions and so forth, which of course changes their ability even to play a mediator in this conflict.
Chris Chermak in Antalya there. Thank you so much for joining us. Still to come on today's Globalist, Andrew Muller is here, bringing us the bits we might have missed from this week's news.
Russia's embassy in Dublin faced an attack which was a rare combination of literal and metaphorical when an enraged local citizen reversed a truck full of religious artefacts through the front gates, giving new meaning to the phrase, holy roller, am I right?
Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
#8:24 in Berlin, #7:24 here in London. Now, the effects of Russia's invasion of Ukraine are beginning to be felt worldwide, in the food industry in particular. From households expecting to pay higher prices in more affluent countries to some nations seeing a distinct shortage of essentials, such as wheat. Well, Jakob Kern is the Deputy Chief of Staff at the World Food Programme and is currently deployed to Poland as the Emergency Coordinator for the Ukraine crisis. He joins us on the line from Krakow. Good morning, Jakob.
Good morning.
Just let's begin at the heart of the conflict at the moment. Could you explain the situation in Ukraine? We have reports that in Mariupol, at least, they have now run out of food.
Yes, indeed. The humanitarian situation is getting very dire, especially in those big cities that are becoming encircled almost. The humanitarian needs are multiplying and they are spreading by the hour. So the big cities, Kiev, Mariupol, Kharkiv, they are the epicenters of the ongoing conflict, as you've seen. And there's reports now of severe food shortages in the eastern part of the Ukraine. The World Food Programme, of course, is committed to stay and deliver and support the people in the Ukraine wherever we can reach them.
What can you do?
Well, at the moment, we are trying to get as much supplies into cities, into the big cities, fill the warehouses. We have contracts from inside. We're buying in the Ukraine part of it. Others we are bringing across and get ready for what we will call humanitarian openings, where we could hopefully deliver humanitarian goods into cities like Mariupol that are going to be encircled pretty soon, we expect.
Tell us a little bit more about the role that Ukraine plays in the world in terms of its supplying food. It is hugely important when it comes to exporting wheat and maize, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's Ukraine and Russia, because now the Black Sea ports are affected. Between Russia and Ukraine, they produce 30% of the world's wheat production, 20% of the maize, 80% of sunflower oil. You can imagine that has an impact not only on the supplies, but also on the price. And it certainly has a big impact on the world food program.
What impact does it have?
The World Food Program has bought 50% of our wheat, which is almost 800,000 tons in 2021 from the Ukraine. And the country offices where we support, Lebanon, for example, 60% of their wheat import is coming from Russia or Ukraine, Egypt, 85%, Yemen, 22%. So if we can't buy it there, we have to buy it somewhere else, and that means longer delivery routes and, of course, higher prices.
Because we have, as you just say there, it is the greatest pinch point at the moment, Jacob, the Middle East and North Africa, or are we going to see this spreading to other parts of the world?
I think the pinch is in terms of supply in the Middle East, Northern Africa, where there will just be not enough wheat to buy in the Ukraine, so they have to go somewhere else. But of course, it has an impact on the entire world, because the price of wheat has gone up 50%, and at some point, you will see the price of bread going up. That may not affect people in the UK or in Germany or in Europe if it's going up 5-10 cents per kilo, but it certainly has an effect on the countries that we are helping. The World Food Program alone, between COVID and this crisis, we have additional costs of $70 million a month just to buy food now. $70 million a month, we could otherwise support 4 million people with food instead of buying higher, more expensive food. So that is a big impact. 4 million people that are needing our assistance in Yemen, in Afghanistan, we cannot support because we don't have the 70 million more that we need every month.
A little later on today, there will be a meeting of the agriculture ministers of the G7, meeting virtually, but the host is Germany. They will be talking about the impact of the invasion on global food security. What can be done here?
Well, other countries will have to step up their production, but wheat production, you cannot just turn on a tap and it's more. It's not oil that you can just increase production from almost one day to the other. You have to make sure that the wheat fields are ready and for production, which is another concern that we have. This is now getting close to the planting season in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine. And if the farmers cannot get their fields sowed, then there won't be any wheat in this fall, in this harvest time. So we'll have a worldwide problem of having not enough wheat, apart from the price increase.
Jacob Kern from the World Food Programme. Thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. The time is 7:30 here in London. A quick update now on the situation in Ukraine. Russian forces have made slow advances towards the Ukrainian capital Kyiv. It's been reported that they are encircling the city. There have also been reports of blasts in two fresh parts of Ukraine overnight. Lutsk and Dnipro, on opposite sides of the country, have been hit for the first time. The UN Security Council is to convene later today at Russia's request to discuss Moscow's claims that the US is engaging in biological activities in Ukraine. Washington has described this as gaslighting. And the US is to join the G7 and European Union in calling for the suspension of normal trade relations with Russia. It's a change that would raise tariffs for many Russian products. Meanwhile, the UN is warning that the number of people leaving Ukraine could pass the 4 million mark in the coming days. More than 2.2 million people have already left. The vast majority have crossed into Poland. And Facebook and Instagram are to allow users in some countries to call for violence against Russians and Russian soldiers. It marks a temporary change to its hate speech policy. And those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Now, as political tensions were escalating, but actual war seemed far off, Monocle's Paige Reynolds was in Kyiv. She was meeting many of the creatives who call the city home. One of those was the Ukrainian fashion designer Lilia Litkovskaya. Lilia Litkovskaya has since fled the city with her family. She's in the safety of Milan via Poland. But the future of her business and the fate of Ukrainian society is uncertain, and the situation is incredibly bleak. Well, as this report describes, Ukrainian fashion has blossomed in the last few years. Brands like Litkovskaya are propelled by a strong, resilient Ukrainian identity. They employ a network of craftspeople and know-how. Though she's now a refugee, the brand now stands as a testament to the potential of democratic Ukraine and its brave, creative entrepreneurs. Paige Reynolds went to meet her.
In downtown Kyiv, walk between the two tricolour flags of Café Charlotte on Torhenevskaya Street, weave your way to the back and up to the fourth floor, and you'll find the showroom of Ukrainian fashion designer Lilia Litkovskaya. On a snowy and rather wet January afternoon, I'm welcomed in by one of Lilia's studio assistants, who leads me into the high-ceilinged room where neatly organised racks of heavy coats and sculptural dresses shoot out of the walls. Lilia's running a little late. She's currently making her way from a production house across town where her newly founded School of Art and Craft runs workshops for young designers. It's a project Lilia is extremely passionate about. What began as just a few Zoom sessions during the first wave of the pandemic, from a desire to pass on her know-how and industry contacts, is now a fully fledged programme where emerging designers, artisans and artists are supported through sponsorships.
I saw the gap because official education, I think, a little bit old school. And private schools don't give the deep knowledges of industry because I know the pattern making, I know everything about fabrics, I know stitching, technology, because I am like addicted of technology and new materials and researching new materials. And I love researching big process. Have to find interesting ideas from different spheres, yeah? And gather in one mood board everything of it we are teaching, yeah, in our school, School Art and Craft.
As Lilia explains, detailed research is an enormous part of her design process. It's particularly apparent when it comes to the elements of traditional Ukrainian craftsmanship she incorporates in her designs, such as old Carpathian weaving techniques. Hailing from four generations of tailors and garment makers, Lilia was exposed to garment production from a young age.
Growing up in this production, I feel everything through my fingers. And for me, very important to save the traditional, but in contemporary way, breathe new blood in old traditional. And the artisanal line, we have artisanal line. This is sustainable line built in this way, built in total traditional way.
In this artisanal line, old production leftovers are collected, sorted into fabric types and reworked into a thread before being weaved into a quilt-like fabric from which one-off pieces are created. While they used to be produced across Ukraine in an ad hoc fashion, depending on which factory had the right know-how or capacity for each product, that's now starting to change.
3 months ago, we opened our big production for produce mass production in one place. But at the same time, we continue to place orders in another production.
Mm. And all in Ukraine?
On Ukraine, yeah.
Since Litkovskaya was founded in 2009, the Ukrainian fashion industry has taken a quantum leap, both in terms of its homegrown scene and international recognition.
Many Ukrainian brands sell all over the world, and we have really strong designers. And I'm sure that Ukrainian artists in different way, musician, photographer, designers, architects, it's like a cluster of creativity. It's like непаханное поле, I don't know, it's like an unplowed field. And I think if you create something special, something and sound from here, it's something special there.
At the time of our interview, tensions were escalating, but there was a sense of disbelief that a Russian invasion would get as far as the city walls. What's happened since is truly unimaginable, and we can only hope that designers and artists such as Lilia still have a city to live and work in the future. Though prior to war entering the capital, I got Lilia's thoughts on what it's like to be a designer in such a volatile environment.
It makes me stronger. And through this not simple way in political, economic situation in Ukraine, developing myself inside to be stronger, to be confident. I would like to tell about Ukraine and Ukrainian artists more and more. We are really a strong nationality.
For Convict Corner in Kyiv, I'm Paige Reynolds.
It's 8:37 in Paris, which is where we head next for today's newspapers. I'm delighted to say Agnès Poirier, journalist and author of the book Notre Dame, the Soul of France, joins us. Good morning, Agnès.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. How's Paris this morning?
It's a bit foggy, but apparently it's going to be very sunny later on. And it was 17 degrees yesterday. It was glorious.
Excellent. Sounds glorious. What's in the papers?
Well, it's less glorious because all the French newspapers are about Ukraine. You could be forgiven to actually think there is even a presidential election in a few weeks' time in France, because it's impossible not to think and not to read about Ukraine. There are very interesting little stories, some very positive. You know, the French families that are welcoming their first refugees from Ukraine, for instance. But there was this reportage that I found very interesting in Le Monde today. They went to one of the most favorite ski resorts of Russian oligarchs in the French Savoie. It's Courchevel, of course. And there was a little controversy because it took a week for the local mayor to actually take down all the Russian flags that were very present in the ski resort. To this day, he says, you know, I'm not taking sides. And Courchevel owes a lot to Russian oligarchs, their families and their second families over the last 25 years, because if they only are about 10% of all the visitors to Courchevel every year, they represent far more in the local economy. And the journalist of Le Monde interviewed a lot of people, and also looked at the Instagram accounts of influencers and young partners of Russian oligarchs. Like there's this one lovely woman called Ilona Katyelyuk, lovely looking at least, who in her last post on the 3rd of March with a picture of a helicopter, wrote, "That's it, c'est fini." She is the partner of the billionaire Nikolai Sarkisov, who owns a lot of chalet in Courchevel and has invested massively in this ski resort. And an estate agent told the journalist from Le Monde that actually for those Russians, there's very little to worry about from sanctions, because many hold two nationalities, and a lot of their chalet are not owned by them individually, personally, but through companies that are based in Luxembourg. So it's going to be a bit of a headache for French authorities, I think, to track down those oligarchs.
You're quite right in the way you describe it as a bit of a headache. I mean, the grander scheme of things, how sympathetic are people in Courchevel to the fact that the oligarchs are now not going to be as welcome as they were?
Well, I mean, you know, the problem, of course, is to dissociate the oligarchs and the families, Russian families that are close to the Kremlin, to wealthy Russians who actually, apparently, you know, the first thing that they say when they come to Courchevel, say, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with Putin. We're against the war. So it's difficult for a lot of the local residents. Say, you know, is it just an attitude? They are doing this when in fact they are close to the Kremlin, but they just want to be left alone. And so it's a difficult situation to be in for local residents having to live with Russians. But it's another thing for French authorities who have to track down all the sanctioned oligarchs and to seize their properties.
You mentioned a moment ago that it's difficult to remember that there is a presidential election happening in France in a few weeks. What are the latest figures suggesting?
Well, it's quite extraordinary, yes. I mean, we haven't thought so much about the presidential elections in the last 2 weeks. President Macron declared at the last minute, just through a letter he addressed to the French in a very sober way. There's a sober mood in France, you know, the same polls, and I'm going to give you the latest intentions of voters, but the same polls are actually asked a few questions to the French about the situation in Ukraine, and 90% of the French are worried. 68% think that the war might actually spread to France. 68%, and 85% of them think that the impact on the French economy is going to be massive. So perhaps now it's normal to think that President Macron is skyrocketing. He's gained almost 9%. In a week. So now 33.5% of the French electorate say they are going to vote for him on the first round. So it means that everybody else is losing ground. Marine Le Pen comes second with 15%, but she's losing ground. Zemmour is at 11%, is doing very badly. And Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the far left candidate, is at 13%. Those three are just paying for their past admiration of Vladimir Putin. You know, the French are not fooled. And of course, Marine Le Pen, Zemmour and Mélenchon are now trying to distend themselves from Putin, but it's a very difficult exercise. Now, if we're looking at Valérie Pécresse, who is Les Républicains candidate, the mainstream right, if you'd like, candidate, she's just falling flat. Like a souffle. She's scoring at 10%. As for Anne Hidalgo, the socialist candidate, it's catastrophic. She's polling at 1.5%. Imagine that. She was polling at 7% in September.
Agnès Poirier, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Paris. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time now to talk trade and economy with Vicky Price, economist and former joint head of the UK government's economic service. Good morning, Vicky.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Just explain to us where we are in the world at the moment in terms of energy costs, oil prices, inflation. It is so unsettled at the moment.
Absolutely. And of course, the markets have been going up and down a little bit. So oil prices had retreated a little bit, in actually quite considerably, in the sense that, you know, we're talking about prices falling from about $130. Dollars per barrel to something like 110, which is where we are right now. That's quite a drop. Gas prices have fallen quite significantly as well. I think what the markets had done, they had priced in what was going on the Ukraine already, and now they're taking stock really of what it actually means in terms of supply and demand. So for the moment, things have eased a little bit. Stock markets, of course, you know, very volatile, falling significantly a few days ago, coming up again a day or so back, and then really not doing fantastically well just very recently. So I'm afraid there is a very, very mixed picture, as you rightly say. And inflation, of course, is the one thing which seems almost certain, because it's going up and up wherever you look. And we've had the data from the US, which shows that we're now just under 8% inflation rate, which is, the highest for something like, 40 years. And that is very unnerving for the markets, and what the implications will be for interest rate increases that we might see beginning next week in the US, and, of course, in the UK as well, where that process has started already.
Let's move on to Russia, where companies who are trying to leave are being threatened by Vladimir Putin of a takeover. Explain to us what that means.
Well, we've seen quite an exodus of companies, or at least that's what they're saying they're going to do. A number of companies are either closing their outlets, that includes, for example, some of the high-value brands like Burberry, but also McDonald's and Coca-Cola and so on. But we've got a much wider issue, which is there's production facilities, there is investment in oil and so on that companies are trying to get out of. What the Russians are saying now is that those that leave will see probably a change in sort of management structure and perhaps investigating ways in which legally a number of those firms can turn into Russian hands, or at least be sold to the ones that want to stay, is really what they're saying. It's not very surprising. The reality is that quite a lot of those assets now will be written off by firms which are already anticipating the losses they will be making. Some cases, of course, remember, we're talking about the percentage of sales in Russia being much, much higher than anyone had really quite understood. So, for example, Mothercare, they're pulling out 25% of their revenues come from Russia, and their share prices have already reflected that. So that the fact that they are pulling out of it. So it is quite a big issue, really, for a number of firms, and of course, for many banks that have been lending to companies that are involved in Russia or directly to Russia.
A case study of what can go wrong for an oligarch was absolutely thrown into the prominence yesterday with the UK imposing sanctions on the Chelsea Football Club leader Roman Abramovich. Without straying too far into the world of celebrity, what does it say about the difficulty of imposing sanctions on incredibly wealthy and influential individuals?
It's not just the question of whether they're incredibly wealthy and influential, but it's also what it is that they were doing with their money. And in this particular case, of course, we're talking about a club which has been very successful, that's Chelsea, where Roman Abramovich has put an awful lot of money, and in fact, so much that he had already said that $1.5 billion, or perhaps it was pounds, that was owed to him, which he had given to Chelsea as a loan. He wasn't expecting to get it back. And of course, when he intended to put the club in for a sale, which he said just before he was sanctioned, he said that the proceeds would go to help the victims in the Ukraine. So the issue really is, can the club can the club survive in the future? Because there are all sorts of restrictions that are being put on it in terms of selling tickets for future matches. And, you know, you can put sanctions, but you're also, of course, have to weigh against that the fact that this is a club which employs lots of people, is important for the UK's standing, if you like. And you can destroy that as well at the same time. So a balancing act, I think, is what's important there.
It's a very difficult one, given the fact that politically it's sensitive. But at the same time, how long is it going to take for these sanctions to take their effect? I mean, there have been accusations that the British government is taking its time.
Yes, and I think the reason why they moved on the Abramovich one is because they have been sort of encouraged to do so by loads of opposition politicians and others, but also backbenchers. So it's not just Abramovich, of course, it's another seven people linked to Putin, apparently, who have been sanctioned that way. But the question really is, at the end of the day, what impact is it going to have? And you know, obviously, in the short term, not very much in terms of any decisions that are made in Russia about the war in Ukraine. But in the longer term, I think the relationship, you know, once you start moving in this direction, it's going to be a very difficult one to re-establish.
Vicky Price, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Finally, to round off the week, Andrew Muller is here to tell us the things we know now that we didn't when the week began.
We learned this week that among the first rank of profiteers from the war in Ukraine may be cartographers and calligraphers, as maps and street signs around the world are mischievously recalibrated in and as gestures of solidarity. We're playing the swell maps, do you see? As this is a bit about maps, and we think these developments are swell.
Ooh, you clever man.
You're so clever.
Clever, Clark.
Smart. Very smart.
We learned that Russia's embassy in Vilnius, beautiful capital of Lithuania, now sits at two Ukraine's heroes, which is going to look awkward on the Russian ambassador's new business cards. We learned that post to Russia's embassy in Tirana, splendid capital of Albania, must henceforth be directed to Free Ukraine Street, and we learned of similar pranks being perpetrated or proposed in Prague, Riga, and London. We learned, however, that it could be worse. Russia's embassy in Dublin faced an attack which was a rare combination of literal and metaphorical when an enraged local citizen reversed a truck full of religious artefacts through the front gates, giving new meaning to the phrase, "Holy roller, am I right?" We learned that the alleged assailant, one Desmond Wisley, proprietor of Wisley Ecclesiastical Supplies, who will do you a Celtic cross sanitizer station for just €123, we're not making this up, was breezily unbothered by being seen to conform to any stereotype of his people, informing arresting officers, "I've done my bit, lads." We then learned that Russia's embassy in Dublin was not only down a front gate, but lacking a sense of proportion. It tweeted as follows, as will now be intoned by Monocle's Pots and Kettles desk chief, Paige Reynolds.
"We believe that no people of sound mind could support such senseless and barbaric actions."
Senseless and barbaric actions, is it? And we're going to need that clip of awkward coughing, chairs being skittishly scraped, etc. Maestro, silly French music. We learned elsewhere that the global stampede to make statements of solidarity with Ukraine and condemnation of Russia, though doubtless coming from a good place, etc., may be getting, perhaps, arguably, maybe, somewhat carried away. We learned that Paris restaurant La Maison de la Poutine, 4 stars on TripAdvisor we checked, had felt, after receiving abusive and even threatening messages, obliged to issue a statement clarifying that the establishment was named in honour of its signature dish, poutine, not the Russian president, Putin.
Okay, fair enough, but let's move on quickly.
I'll give you that, I guess.
Okay. We learned that a similar eatery in Quebec, Leroy Giuseppe, had sought to forestall such contumely by changing the name of poutine on its menus to La Frite Fromage Sauce. Really, though, there is no excuse for confusing Putin and poutine, as one is a doer, dodgy, frumpy concoction of profoundly unwholesome ingredients which no decent person should ever have wanted anything to do with, and the other is actually no, we cannot bring ourselves to go through with this cheap bait-and-switch device. They're both just terrible. It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. Elsewhere, we learned that the backlash could at least get amusingly personal. Here in the UK, the Loaf and Cheese, a pub in Burton-upon-Trent, believed to be a settlement in the vicinity of Staffordshire, has taken a stand and or scared up an amount of free publicity by declaring that Vladimir Putin is henceforth barred from their premises. The landlady further declaring that if the Russian president did attempt, for example, to join the audience for this Sunday's afternoon show by Mark Bolton, much acclaimed locally for his impressions of, among others, Elton John, Frankie Valli, Peter Andre and Tom Jones, and now the musical backing makes sense, her customers would, quote, wreck him. Tickets still seem to be available. We also learned that one Polish mayor has a long memory. Wojciech Bakun, mayor of Szemyszyn, which abuts the border with Ukraine, found himself descended upon by former Italian deputy prime minister, leader of the Lega party, and massive jackass Matteo Salvini. The joint press conference went suboptimally for Salvini.
Zrobiła tym ludziom, którzy tutaj w ilości 50 tysięcy dziennie przekracza granicę. Prosiłbym, żebyśmy wspólnie pojechali. Właśnie pojedziemy zaraz do ośrodka dla uchodźców i pojedziemy na granicę, jeżeli będzie pan w tej koszulce. Zapraszam, panie senatorze. No respect for you. Thank you.
What you are hearing there is Mayor Bakun offering to take Salvini to visit Ukrainian refugees so long as Salvini wears the same Vladimir Putin t-shirt he triumphantly sported when visiting Moscow in 2014. So we continue to learn that if there is to be one minor consolation to this disaster, it might hopefully be the abashed scuttling of every grifter who has grovelled in Moscow's direction these last few years. Speaking of which, however, we learned, disappointingly, that one cohort of those in cahoots with Putin will actually benefit from Russia's ostracising. For we learned that among those who appear to have only just noticed that Vladimir Putin has been presiding over some sort of predatory gangster state is the bad singer Sting, who has sonorously announced that he will never again trouser a bung for performing private shows for wealthy and presumably deaf Russian oligarchs. Now of all times, why should they escape punishment? Where's the gong? I've wanted to do this for years. When I said to you, I hope the Russians love their children too. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, Andrew. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to all our guests and to our producers, Paige Reynolds, Emma Sell and Charlie Phil-McCourt, our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, Lillian Fawcett, Samson Mbogo and our studio manager, Nora Hall, with editing and assistance from Christy Evans. After the headlines, more music on the way, the briefing's live at midday in London, The Globalist is back at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.